Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
The cost of health insurance in California. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCIW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Two of California's biggest health insurance companies have cut back on hefty increases in rates. Blue Shield says it wants to make coverage affordable during tough economic times. But it also turns out that tough economic times have forced customers to switch to cheaper policies and go to doctors less often, reducing company payouts. We'll talk with the new state insurance commissioner and others. On the first anniversary of President Obama's health care reform, is it helping or hurting Californians? Later on are revolutions transforming the Middle East. First, here's the news. Warman Alney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. People power has raised hopes for fundamental change in the entrenched dictatorships of the Middle East. But in Egypt today, street protests, strikes, and sit-ins were criminalized by Hosni Mubarak's military successors. We'll hear more on the possible consequences of revolution there and elsewhere. First, on this anniversary of President Obama's health care reform, we'll talk about health insurance. Anthem Blue Cross has reduced and delayed proposed rate increases for some 500,000 Californians. Blue Shield has delayed proposed hikes for about 200,000 people. Tom Epstein worked in the Clinton White House during the health reform battle of 1993. He is now Vice President for Public Affairs at Blue Shield of California. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Warren.
Very carefully, I want to say you are not representing Blue Cross, but only Blue Shield.
That is correct.
Why did you ask for these? These were big cuts, 87% for some people. Why did you propose them, and why have you now delayed them?
We asked for increases in the individual market because we're actually losing money on that line of business. We lost $27 million last year and expect to lose money again this year. But we withdrew the increases because we decided that it was impossible to really have a good conversation about what's driving the cost of health care as long as people were that concerned about the rate changes. I do want to add, too, that the March increase that we pulled was only 6.5% on average. Those large numbers you heard were an aggregate of 2 years' worth of increases.
Okay. And anyway, you got a lot of adverse public reaction, I take it. Is that why you withdrew them or delayed them?
We wanted to change the subject. We wanted to be able to talk about what's really driving these premium increases, which is the amount of money that we're obliged to spend on hospitals and physicians and prescription drugs for our members. That's what's really rising so fast. It's causing these premiums to go up.
Isn't it also true, though, that because of there being hard times, people are changing policies, getting cheaper ones, not going to doctor's offices as often because in many cases they have to pay more? Or pay less, rather?
Yeah. People are switching to policies that have a lower premium but also have higher deductibles, and that can cause them to delay care that they might otherwise need. We think that's unfortunate. It's one of the reasons that we've supported health care reform for the last 10 years. We believe that by having everybody covered and having a standard benefit package, that will make it easier for everybody to get the care they need at the right time in the right setting.
But it seems to me two things are going on at the same time. On the one hand, you say you have to pay more to hospitals, doctors, and for drugs, but that the actual payouts may be less because people are getting cheaper policies and going to doctors, hospitals, and buying less drugs.
Yeah, when they're buying cheaper policies, of course, that means we're taking in less money in premium, so it all balances out.
Does balance out. So if you want to change the subject, how would you change it? This is a conversation that's been going on for a long, long time, especially for you. You go all the way back to the Clinton administration.
Right. The thing that we think is important is to really focus on what's driving the cost of premiums. We spend about 85% in total of all the money we bring in on hospitals, doctors, and prescription drugs. And if we want to really do something about premiums, we need to reduce the amount that we're spending on medical care. Those prices keep going up in double digits year after year after year. About half the money goes to hospitals. And so we need to look for efficiencies. We need to find new ways to provide good quality care at a lower cost. And we've been working with hospitals and doctors up in Northern California in particular on what's called an accountable care organization, where we all work together to keep costs down. We share the risk, and we've actually given the CalPERS members in Northern California a zero rate increase over the last year, and it's worked out.
What about these this pattern, though, of asking for increases and then delaying them or withdrawing them? There are a lot of people who say this is really a game.
It's not a game. It's a business risk that we took because we wanted to really get people focused on what's driving the cost of care. We felt it was becoming a distraction when people were always talking about our rates, or when the media was always talking about our rates. And, you know, we want to focus on the good that health reform can do. We want to focus on how we can really reduce the medical costs that are driving these premiums. And we thought the best way to do that was to take these rates off the table for now.
Best thing for you about health care reform is that it has a mandate, isn't it, so that everybody has to buy a policy?
The health reform does include a mandate. It's not a very strong mandate. We would actually like to see even more incentives for everybody to get coverage, because that's really best for everyone. If everyone's in the system, then we know that everybody's going to get the care they need. They're going to get the preventive services. We're going to share the risk between people who have high medical costs and those who don't, and the system will work better, be more efficient for everyone if we all get covered.
All right, Tom Epstein, again, Vice President, Public Affairs, Blue Shield of California. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
Dave Jones is the insurance commissioner for the state of California, formerly a state assemblyman, a Democrat. He was elected insurance commissioner last November. Commissioner, good to have you back on our program.
It's great to be back on this, the one-year anniversary of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, the federal health care reform bill.
Let me ask you something. Tom Epstein didn't want to interact with you. You didn't want to interact with Tom Epstein. What does that tell us about your ability to get along with the insurance companies? Are you having problems?
Oh, I'm always happy to interact with the insurance companies, and we've done exactly that. Literally 48 hours after I was sworn in, news broke about Blue Shield and Blue Crosses and the other health insurers' most recent rate hikes. I asked them to delay for 60 days. Blue Shield, unfortunately, initially declined. The other companies agreed, and then Blue Shield agreed. And we've used those 60 days to good effect to look very carefully at the underlying rate filings. And we're most appreciative of the fact that Blue Shield announced last week that it was dropping the third of its three rate increases in less than a year, the 6.5% average one, which will save Blue Shield policyholders, some 233,000 people, $40 million in premiums. And Anthem Blue Cross announced on Monday that they were reducing their rate increase by 7 points and delaying increases in deductibles, and that will save their 600,000 or so policyholders some $40 million. But I think all this underscores one important point, and it probably surprised your listeners to learn this. The insurance commissioner does not have the authority to reject excessive rate hikes. I can scrutinize the rates. I can make sure that their mathematical calculations are accurate. I can make sure that they put 80 cents on the dollar into health care, which is an important component of the new Federal Health Care Reform Act. But I can't reject the rates due to excessivity. I'd like to have that authority. I've been fighting to get it for the last 6 years, but the insurance companies have resisted it. We have a bill in the legislature that would give me that authority, Assembly Bill 52.
Well, were the increases that have been asked and now either delayed or withdrawn truly excessive? We just heard from Tom Epstein that 85% rather than 80% of their premium money goes to pay hospitals, drugs, and doctors and for drugs.
Well, I think it's important to note that Blue Shield of California, the parent company of the life insurance company, made $315 million in net equity in 2010 and $149 million in 2009. The 2010 figure is a return on equity of 8.8%. This is in the height of the worst recession this nation has had since the Great Depression, and that's a healthy return. I didn't make a final determination as to excessivity in that Blue Shield withdrew their rate filing, and we're appreciative that they did so. But I think from the standpoint of individual consumers, there's no question that these rate increases year after year, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50%, The cumulative impact on some of Blue Shield's policyholders, about 20,000 or so of the third of these three rate hikes, would have been 87%. It's just not sustainable. It explains why we have 7 million Californians who don't have health insurance. And so we've got to move forward with implementation of the Health Care Reform Act, but also build on it. And one of the ways we could build on it is to give me the same authority that I have for car insurance and home insurance and property insurance, and that is the ability to reject excessive rate hikes.
There is a bill, I take it. You carried it when you were in the Assembly. It's now being carried by Mike Fuhr, who's here in Los Angeles. What are its chances of passage? And if it passes, what about the governor?
I think the chances are good, but it's going to be a hard fight. I mean, the insurance industry was successful in defeating that bill three times in the past when I carried it. We haven't spoken to the governor. The governor is focused, as he should be, on solving the state's budget crisis, and so we'll have an opportunity to talk to him as the bill moves along. But it's an important bill. It has, in the auto insurance context, saved consumers tens of billions of dollars since the Department of Insurance has had that authority under Proposition 103 since 1988. And I think health insurance is every bit as important as auto insurance. I do agree that medical costs are going up. I don't believe that they're the sole driver of health insurance or managed care premiums, but there's no question that we need to focus on that too, and that's why the Affordable Care Act has investments in things like primary care and preventative care that are designed to try to get the medical costs down, that has new structures for delivery of care that are designed to try to get the costs down. But as long as the hospitals and other medical providers know that there's no constraint on the outer end, there's no legal authority for the insurance commissioner to say no to rate increases, these sorts of things just get passed through the system and consumers end up paying. And that's why I think the legislature should give me the authority, because we can then say, well, look, enough is enough.
But if costs are not the sole driver of premium increases, what else is?
Oh, I think things like administrative costs, marketing costs, if you look at the returns of insurance companies as well, these are all elements that are incorporated into premiums and help explain why premiums are going up.
All right, Dave Jones, thanks again for being with us. Good to have you.
Thank you.
Once again, this is the anniversary of President Obama's health care reform. He signed it exactly 1 year ago, which had passed, of course, at the time that it had passed, without a single Republican vote in the House or the Senate. Recent polls show that the public is still divided about it, with a plurality opposed to the measure but large majorities favoring various provisions. Dina Lahn is policy director for the Children's Defense Fund in California. Dina Lahn, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
What's good about it? In what ways is it benefiting California, do you think, right now?
Well, let me just first of all talk about the polling that you mentioned. I think one of the problems with health care reform is it's very, very complicated. And so people like me who spend all their time with their head in the weeds really need to back up and look at these polling results and realize that one of the problems is that people don't understand it. And I think the most important thing that people need to understand is that what's called the individual mandate, the requirement that everybody have insurance, doesn't change things for people who already have insurance. So if you're lucky enough to be covered like I am and many others are by your employer, that's it. You're done. You don't have to go buy any new insurance. You're going to get a lot of protections in the Affordable Care Act, but you're done. The individual mandate just assures that people won't wait till they're sick to get health insurance. It kind of evens out the cost for everybody in two ways. One, by having everybody have health insurance, the pool is bigger and you've got healthy and less healthy people in there. And the second is that because people switch from health to not healthy in the time it takes to get in an auto accident or be diagnosed with cancer, it assures that those people will have coverage. So even young people, for example, who may feel invulnerable, this way they don't end up in the ER every time they've got a problem. They're going to have coverage for preventive care. So I just want to say that I think the polling showed that people, once they understand it, are much more comfortable with it.
What is it they like?
What people like? Well, I'll tell you some of the benefits, and we focus on children, so I'll start with that. Some of the children's provisions kicked in early. One of the really great things, and we really did a good job implementing this in California, is that while adults get protection from being denied for pre-existing conditions starting in 2014, for kids it started already. So we in California implemented an open enrollment period during which the cost of getting this coverage would not be as expensive. Parents can enroll their kids anytime. It's just that around their birthday, which will be the open enrollment period, or there was a window to enroll them in the beginning, their costs were limited. And this is incredible. When I first started working in health insurance, I thought pre-existing conditions meant something very serious. Turns out insurance companies can deny people coverage for things like acne or asthma or being moderately overweight. So the great thing already is that over 1.1 million Californians under age 25 who have pre-existing health conditions, they can't be denied coverage anymore.
Okay.
And that's really critical.
And in addition, there are many other benefits as well, but one
right.
of them I know is that parents can keep their kids on their insurance policies until they're 26.
Exactly. So this is a group that had high rates of uninsurance because, for the most part, they were very healthy. But as I said, you never know what's going to happen. And what this is just saying is if you have your dependents covered already, you can keep them covered till age 26. Most kids who get out of college, their first job does not have health insurance. They might be doing an internship. They might be traveling. They might be going back to school. They wouldn't have health insurance. So that's another
okay.
big thing. Another big thing.
Well,
that,
excuse me. Let me interrupt you because I want to go to our next guest. We'll have a little back and forth here. Dina Lahn is policy director for the Children's Defense Fund in California, based in Oakland. John Graham is director of healthcare studies at the Pacific Research Institute. That's a free market think tank headquartered in San Francisco. And John Graham, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
You're opposed to this act, as I understand it. What's wrong with what we just heard? A mandate that helps to smooth out the costs, the ability for children to be covered without, even if they have pre-existing conditions, adults as well, in 2014, and the idea that parents can keep their kids on their policies until they're 26.
Well, one thing is someone has to pay for them, and that's one reason why premiums are going up, and that's going to get worse as time goes on. Another way to put some of the things you've said is this issue of pre-existing conditions. If I, the polling questions on pre-existing conditions, it's about 70% in favor. But if I turn that upside down and say, should you have the right to wait until you become sick to buy health insurance, obviously people would ask a very different question. Well, that's what Obamacare does. And you can't enforce an individual mandate on most people. A comprehensive family health plan policy, the national average now is we're up to almost $14,000-$15,000 a year. You can't enforce that mandate. That's why Obamacare is so darned expensive. It's subsidizing people to acquire health insurance in these exchanges. And the consumer protections that we heard about just a few moments ago, if these were so great, the Secretary of Health and Human Services would not have issued 1,000 waivers to employers, to union-backed groups, to insurers, and just recently to a state, the entire state of Maine, exempting them for 1 year from these so-called consumer protections. That's kind of unheard of. I'm not really used to people demanding to be exempted from consumer protections. The high-risk pools are one thing that was supposed to be a great protection. They came in last year that if you were denied coverage because of a pre-existing condition, until these protections come into force for adults in January 2014, you were supposed to be able to go to a high-risk pool. They thought millions and millions of people would apply for these high-risk pools. They had 280,000 people nationwide apply for these high-risk pools. People do not really see these as benefits. They see bureaucracy. They see cost. They see central government control of your access to medical care. 40% approximately of the funding for Obamacare comes out of Medicare. Seniors are hardcore in opposition to Obamacare. They've been into Medicare all their lives, and they don't want to see Medicare plan cut.
All right. I'm going to interrupt you, too, John Graham, with the Pacific Research Institute in San Francisco. We don't have a lot of time left. Dina Lahn, as quickly as you can, what about all these things, particularly the cost? This is what John Graham says is driving the premiums up.
Right. Well, I think everybody pays, and the question is, are you going to have a system, as imperfect as it is, where at least you're going to try to change the incentives to encourage people to have preventive care? That's what the ACA, what he's calling Obamacare, does. It basically says we're going to make it cheaper for people to get preventive care, and we're going to even out the risk.
Okay, John Graham, won't that bring ultimately the cost down?
No, it won't, and we have evidence it won't. You know, Medi-Cal has free preventive care. You're in Los Angeles County. Are the emergency rooms not full of people on Medi-Cal? Of course they are, because primary care doctors won't see people on Medi-Cal. Once the full force of government control of, you know, through Obamacare kicks in 2014, private insurance is going to look a lot more like Medi-Cal, and even Medicare patients now on the traditional Medicare program are having trouble getting appointments with doctors.
Okay, that's all the time we have. We wanted to give people a sample of the debate as it continues. Familiar arguments, they'll be going on for a long time. Thank you both, John Graham with the Pacific Research Institute, Dina Lahn with the Children's Defense Fund. I'll be back in a moment with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayla. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warman Olney back with Which Way LA. One of Hollywood's biggest stars and one of the world's great celebrities died last night at Cedars-Sinai. Elizabeth Taylor was 79 years old.
Command performances leave me quite cold. I've had more fun in the back seat of a 39 Ford than I could ever have in the vault of the Chase National Bank.
Elizabeth Taylor in Butterfield 8, 1960, for which she won an Academy Award. In 60 years of film, Elizabeth Taylor appeared in more than 50. She won two Oscars, was nominated for several others. She was married 8 times, twice to the leading man, Richard Burton, and she was known as a relentless campaigner against HIV/AIDS. Kenneth Turan is a film critic for the Los Angeles Times and NPR, and Kenneth, good always to have you on our program.
Great to be here, Warren.
You rattle off those kinds of facts, and yet there's just so much more to say about Elizabeth Taylor, an extraordinary presence in our country for a long period of time.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of a cliche, but you really feel, you know, with her death that we'll just not see her like again. There was no one who really was combined this kind of really superior acting ability with really dramatic personal life and had the two kind of feed off of each other. The more dramatic her personal life got, kind of the better her acting got, and vice versa. And it was hard to tell what was more gripping, her personal story or what she did on screen.
There's a wonderful quote from Roddy McDowell, and here it is. Her life was played out in print, miles of newspaper and magazine articles, a galaxy of photographs, and a shelf of biographies, each one painting a different portrait. Planes, trains, everything stops for Elizabeth Taylor, but the public has no conception of who she is, he says. People who damn her, wish her to hell because they could do what they think. Well, excuse me. People who damn her, wish to hell, they could do what they think she does. Let me get it straight there from Roddy McDowell. That's a pretty good summary.
That's a great quote. And, you know, Roddy McDowell knew her. He was almost a lifelong friend, and they were kind of child actors together. And no, I mean, really, she's from another era. We really didn't know what she was like. You know, we thought we did. We got the news reports, but really, you know, she was kind of mysterious. There was no reality TV. There was none of these glimpses into people's lives. She was a star, and she knew it.
What were some of the surprises? What were the things people learned that ultimately that they hadn't expected?
Oh, I mean, I think the dramatic things that happened in her romantic life, I think, really flabbergasted people. You know, her first husband, Mike Todd, maybe I think he was her third husband, dying in a plane crash. She takes up with Eddie Fisher, who was then married to Debbie Reynolds, who was America's sweetheart, and they were supposed to have this wonderful marriage, and here comes Elizabeth Taylor. Then she takes up with Richard Burton on the set of Cleopatra, you know, these two Titanic temperaments. It was really this stuff that would happen would kind of, you know, beggar the imagination.
And then there was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Yes, you know, where she revealed real dramatic range and real fierceness and anger on screen. I mean, she was a real actress. I mean, she was not a personality. She was not a gorgeous woman who got by just on being gorgeous. She could really act.
She could really act, and particularly with Richard Burton. Were there others, other leading men that she related to so effectively in the movies?
Well, the one I think of immediately is Montgomery Clift, who was a close personal friend of hers, and one of her first key, you know, adult-type roles in A Place in the Sun. She co-stars with him, and there's a real powerful kind of dynamic between the two of them. You know, she was so beautiful, you could believe that a man, that Montgomery Clift, would do anything, even murder, you know, to win her affections. That's how strong the bond was.
You've written about her eyes.
oh, her eyes were really famous, this wonderful indigo color and violet color, I guess I should say. And they were, you know, you see them on screen, you never forget them. And in life, they were apparently just as powerful, maybe even more so.
She started out, as you mentioned, as a child actor. At what point did she become a sex symbol?
Oh, gosh. I think maybe with A Place in the Sun when she was only 17. You know, you see the film, she comes off as much older. She was only 17. I think the film was, she was 19 when the film came out, but George Stevens filmed her when she was only 17. And there's some big close-ups of her face in that film that are just staggering today. I don't know what they were like at that time, but even today they're staggering.
Make you want to weep. You mentioned George Stevens. She worked with a lot of other important directors.
Yeah, no, she made a lot, as you mentioned, she made a lot of films. She worked with strong directors and quite an extraordinary career.
Extraordinary indeed. Kenneth Turan, a film critic for the Los Angeles Times, thanks a lot for telling us about it.
Thank you, Warren.
Okay, someone we will miss, as you say. We will not see her like again. You can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, our Revolutions Transforming the Middle East on Which Way LA. Warren Alney back with Which Way LA. Since dictators were deposed by people power in Tunisia and Egypt, there's been talk of an Arab Spring that would finally bring an end to authoritarianism in the Middle East, even a flowering of democracy. As Allied strikes continue in Libya, President Obama had this hopeful message for CNN.
Potentially, what we may see is that all the enthusiasm the Libyan people had for a change in government that was occurring a few weeks ago, but that Gaddafi, through just brutal application of force, made people fearful, that can resurface. And it may be that it's not a matter of military might, but instead an idea that's come to the Libyan people that it's time for a change that ends up ultimately sweeping Gaddafi out of power.
Scott Peterson writes for the Christian Science Monitor. He currently is in the Libyan capital of Tripoli. Scott Peterson, welcome back to our program.
Thank you.
What can you tell us, based on what we just heard from the president, about the idea that although it was brutally repressed, there is something in the Libyan people that indicates it's time for a change?
Well, I think there are a lot of people here who really do want some kind of change, a lot of people. But I think that they've also felt that they've been knocked back from the optimism that many of them felt many, many weeks ago. They felt that in the aftermath of the Tunisian and the Egyptian revolutions, that that Libya was next. I mean, we had many cities. There were very, very large protests. They erupted. The scenario appeared to be the same. But what really began to change things, of course, was the fact that the government and the security and military forces of Muammar Gaddafi began to repress very powerfully those elements that had broken up or risen up, and so this has really been a different dynamic, and we now see and seem to be seeing, despite the no-fly zone and the application of military force, a settling in on the ground, which could yield to a very, very long end game playing out.
So things may not end quickly, obviously. Are you still hearing the sound of the bombings in Tripoli?
Well, I don't expect that we're going to hear too much tonight. There's just been some shooting off toward the direction of that green square, which is, of course, where there's been a lot of celebratory celebrations going on, flag waving, and it's kind of a surreal scene. People are celebrating, and they were doing this also, shooting into the air, even when those cruise missile strikes were going on over the last few nights. Now, of course, senior military commanders, U.S. military commanders, have said that they think that this operation is now shifting into much more of an operation that's going to target ground forces, and also that basically they've already degraded the defense air defense systems enough so that they're not going to have to do too many more strikes. I'm not expecting that it's going to be too noisy in Tripoli tonight.
You've looked into the history of popular revolutions and their aftermaths and outcomes. What can you tell us, particularly by comparison to the anticipation that an Arab Spring might be in process and that we might see even democracy in some of these countries?
Well, I think what's extraordinary, and what's been extraordinary for Arabs that have taken part in these various countries, and those who, of course, are still engaged in them in so many countries, is the very high level of expectations that they have. And I think this is going to be one of the most crucial things for those new leaders in Tunisia, those new leaders in Egypt, and those new leaders that will appear as, you know, various autocratic regimes disintegrate, they are going to have to manage expectations of people who have taken to the streets, who have, you know, fought and demonstrated against and brought down these regimes for all sorts of different motivations. Some went there because they didn't have enough money to feed their families, or they didn't have jobs, or they couldn't do enough with their education. You know, all of these different things that people were expecting, and sometimes people really do feel, and we've heard this again and again, immediate change is what they're expecting. Well, of course, they're going to be disappointed, and now we're beginning already to see in some of these countries a degree of disappointment setting in, people asking themselves, how deep were these revolutions that we exacted? I mean, is it the fact that we've only removed the dictator without actually changing the system that we really grew to detest? So there are going to be all kinds of sliding scales that will be used as a measurement of the success of these revolutions. And if what comes out at the end is something that's a more representative process, something even that one might call democracy, I mean, that in some cases will probably be pretty miraculous.
Scott Peterson again, a staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor. Thanks very much for joining us from what must be a difficult place to be right now in Tripoli. It's good to have you on our program. Ashraf Khalil is a journalist based in Cairo for Foreign Policy Magazine and the Times of London. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, thanks for being
here. There are reports today that the Egyptian cabinet, the military organization that succeeded Hosni Mubarak, has proposed a new law, or perhaps enacted a new law, that would now criminalize some forms of protest. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the information is still coming in, but apparently the law has been approved that criminalizes protests and sets a hefty fine and a sentence of up to a year in prison for protests that affect the economy or disrupt the economy or damage property. And I'm still trying to work through what this means, but this is a very worrisome sign. I'm shocked, actually.
You're shocked. You were one of those who thought that things might be moving in what we would call the right direction in Egypt.
Yeah. If you talked to me a couple of days ago, I would have sounded a lot more optimistic and basically saying that this is going to be a struggle, that the building a democratic society is messy. And I suppose I'm still a little bit optimistic, but this is a bad sign. I mean, we have to see what this means. The language that's being used can be interpreted in a lot of different ways, but criminalizing protests, I don't think the people who ousted President Mubarak did that so that protests would be criminalized. This is disturbing.
There are those who say that the Egyptian people, based on what we saw over the last few weeks, simply won't tolerate this kind of thing. Is there any indication that this has now become well enough known that there's been time for some sort of backlash?
Well, I think the reaction to this is going to be split. There is a significant percentage of the population that wants to see things return to normal. You've had, ever since Mubarak stepped down, you had a wave of labor actions, you've had factory strikes, you've had civil servants striking, and to the point where it is halting the resumption of a normal economy, and you're getting a very strong public sentiment against that and wanting to see things just normalize. And obviously this is going to play into that, but you're going to get a very harsh repudiation of this from activist groups, and I think you're going to see people challenging it and basically taking to the streets and challenging the government to arrest them all.
I've seen reports today on CNN and elsewhere that some of the protesters from Tahrir Square have lately been seized by military forces and in some cases badly mistreated.
Yeah, this has been a story that's been bubbling for more than a week now, in that there have been a number of detentions. There have been a lot of accounts of mistreatment. There are some very disturbing accounts of female protesters who were arrested by the military being threatened and subjected to quote-unquote virginity tests. And I'll let your listeners kind of paint a picture of what that means. I'm a little bit troubled by the way, the turn that things have taken, and the behavior of the military council that's running Egypt at this point.
Ashraf Khalid, again, joining us from Cairo. Khalil Johnson is Johnson is a lecturer in international studies and languages at Pepperdine University, and he's also executive director at its Washington, D.C. internship program, Pepperdine being a Southern California institution. He formerly was president of the National Association of Arab Americans. Mr. Johnson, thank you very much for being on our program.
My pleasure. Thank you, Warren.
Tell us your reaction, if you will, to what we just heard from Cairo.
Well, I frankly, there is nothing surprising thus far. Definitely, I agree with what you spoke of earlier as the Arab Spring that is in progress in the Middle East. What we have seen over the past few weeks, a couple of months, definitely is fresh air, definitely is a welcome sign. The fall of the wall of fear that prevented Arab citizens in various Arab countries from expressing themselves and articulating their own aspirations is a good sign. However, this is a very kind of difficult road ahead. To talk about ending authoritarianism or a flowering of democracy, I believe, is premature. All these countries, whether it's Tunisia or Egypt or Libya, what we are seeing here is resistance to this Arab Spring that is in progress. It's still there. It's still moving forward. But I think it's going to be a while before we see genuine and, more importantly, functional democracy in these countries.
What about those people who are, as we just heard, concerned about a return to a normal a situation without all of the demonstrations and the labor actions and so on, people who have to make a living?
I see that. As a matter of fact, you know, that this started brewing, you know, several weeks ago. The demonstrations, if you will, or the revolution itself, when it started, it definitely disrupted normalcy as, you know, people knew it in Egypt before the demonstrations. In the sense that even though people in general welcomed these demonstrations and welcomed the changes that these demonstrations brought about, but I think they are yearning, or they began to express voices of yearning or looking forward for normalcy, for restoration of the status quo, in the sense of, you know, the need to go back to work. I mean, remember, we have a majority in Egypt that live on daily cash, that live the average in the Egyptian, about 40% or 50% of the Egyptian people live on less than $2 per day. So if these people have been demonstrating for a month or two, definitely they not only ran out of money, but they probably ran out of philanthropy or other organizations or individuals who've been helping them to stay in business, if you allow me to use that expression. So there is a yearning for normalcy, but at the same time, there are other factors at play. There is resistance from power centers that have dominated Egypt for a long time, including the military. I'm one of those who were not so excited about this role by the military in Egypt. I do not have any trust in the military. Militaries, you know, as a student of history, I do not see militaries as having produced democracies necessarily, and the military has been applying brakes day in, day out in terms of this revolution in Egypt.
Again, Khalil Jassan is former president of the National Association of Arab Americans. One person who has said this, Arabs are not going to accept a return to authoritarianism, is Shadi Hamid. He is director of research at the Brookings Doha Center, and he's a fellow at the Brookings Institution. He joins us from Washington today. Normally he is in Qatar. Thank you very much, Shadi Hamid, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Given what's happened in Egypt today, namely that the military regime has announced that it is criminalizing a protest, do you still feel that Arabs are not going to accept a return to authoritarianism, or is this going to be a longer process than you might have hoped?
Well, this was bound to happen. I mean, with revolutions, you have the initial phase of optimism, then people's expectations are not met. And wherever there's a revolution, there's going to be a counter-revolution not far behind. And that's what we're seeing now, that the forces of repression or authoritarianism are becoming more emboldened, not just in Egypt, but throughout the region. There is resistance to real democratic change. Now, I don't think Egyptians are going to accept this. And already, I mean, they're angry. and they're mobilized, and if need be, I think they have the capability to go back into the streets. I think the barrier of fear has already been broken, and it's difficult to see how or why Arabs would go back to the previous situation where they would accept things from these regimes. I don't think we're talking about that.
We just heard from Cairo, though, that for the past week or so, there have been more and more reports of demonstrators who are in the square and who appeared to be victorious, seized by the military, beaten by the military, tortured. We even heard of females threatened with what are referred to as virginity tests. There hasn't been street protest against that I'm aware of.
No, there haven't been. And, I mean, these reports that we're hearing are quite shocking, that the military is using brutal tactics and torture. And this has surprised a lot of people who saw the military as their savior. Yes, we haven't seen a mass mobilization in protest of that. But I think we're at a stage where people are a little bit exhausted. It's difficult to ask hundreds of thousands of people to take to the streets every week for a different issue. So I think this is the time for the opposition in Egypt to regroup and to come up with a strategy. I think a big problem is the revolutionaries in Egypt haven't been able to go on to the next phase of action. They don't have a clear plan. And I think now strategy becomes very important and leadership becomes very important. And they have to unify and coalesce around a common vision. But unfortunately, we're seeing more and more divisions within the opposition.
Mark Levine is a professor of modern Middle Eastern history at UC Irvine. His most recent book is Heavy Metal Islam. He also produced a compilation album featuring hard rock, metal, and hip-hop bands from around the Muslim world. It's called Flowers in the Desert. Professor, thank you very much for joining
us today. Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us what your take is on what appears to be a counter-revolution going on, not just in Egypt, but also elsewhere in the Middle East.
Well, I think as your previous guest said, you know, the counter-revolution was inevitable. I was in Tahrir when Mubarak left, and while people were jubilant, especially I was with many of the main activists, they were jubilant, of course, but almost immediately they started meeting to try to figure out what to do next. People understood that the army was not their friend, that there was a coalescing of interests between the protesters and the army to get rid of Mubarak, and it had to do with especially economic issues. But, you know, it was obvious that the army was going to try to maintain power because no army that has that much power ever gives it up willingly. What I think the issue is now is how do you reach out to the vast majority, 60, 70 million Egyptians who did not protest, who might be happy Mubarak is gone, but who have so little hope for a much better future that a return to the status quo without Mubarak seems like the best they can get. If the protest movement and the democracy movement can appeal to them, can focus on economic issues especially, since 40% of Egyptians roughly live on $2 a day or less, they can recapture this momentum. And that's where I think your previous guests were right. Strategy becomes crucial.
You obviously are close to the young people involved with the kind of music approach that you have taken. Tell us about that generation and what their real goals seem to be, and are they in fact as revolutionary as they were made out to be during the events in Tahrir Square?
Well, I think the revolutionary thing was the idea that they deserve what everyone else in the world wants. They want democracy. They want the chance to not just get a good education, but to have a decent life and have a decent future. Their goals are no different than the goals of my students. It's just their situation is so much worse that they had no choice but to take to the streets. The issue is how much can these goals resonate with other Egyptians? And here you have two issues. You have class, which is an issue. Most of the people who were the main revolutionaries, of course, were middle and upper middle class, Western educated, very web savvy, etc. And also age. You know, these are people, let's say you had younger members of the Muslim Brotherhood who were very active in this movement, but then you had older members of the Brotherhood who we can already see are thinking about cutting deals or joining forces, at least politically, with the very NDP party that oppressed them in order to get a situation in place where they can get many more votes when the parliamentary elections come. So there's generational conflicts, there's class conflicts, there's conflicts between rural and urban that all are going to play out. And, you know, we have to remember the French Revolution took decades to play itself out. The American Revolution arguably didn't play out until the Civil War. This is the beginning of a very, very long process that's going to play out across the Arab world. And it also involves us and what we're willing to do as the United States and the Europeans in terms of our actual support for democracy. So Hillary Clinton being in Tahrir Square but saying nothing about the abuses that were going on in that square only a few days earlier is not a good signal to the young people of that country.
Mark Levine, again, a professor at UC Irvine, University of California at Irvine, and author of Heavy Metal Islam. Thomas Carruthers is Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. It's good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you, Warren.
What's your take on what's going on, not just in the countries we've talked about, but some of the others as well, including Yemen and Bahrain, where Saudi Arabian troops have been brought in, Yemen, where there appears to be an effort to there by his own military to get rid of the president, but who just isn't going to leave?
Well, in some ways, because the Arab world has been so authoritarian kind of across the sweep of the region, we've assumed as these events unfolded that it's a kind of unitary wave and that it should be understood as a unitary phenomenon. And we've often, there's been a tendency to compare it to the wave in Central and Eastern Europe, which is really not a good reference point because Central and Eastern Europe was more similar to each other as regimes or societies than the Arab countries are. And so the difference in political structure in a place like Yemen, for example, conflicting mix of tribes versus a country like Tunisia, which had a sort of family dictatorship of a certain type. We're comparing apples and oranges, and if we expect, you know, an outburst of a desire for dignity and freedom to have similar effects across the region, then we were misunderstanding the region to start with.
Khalil Jassan, back to you again, former president of the National Association of Arab Americans. You're of Palestinian descent, as I understand it. There was today a bombing in Jerusalem at a bus station. Apparently one person killed and several others wounded, 30 or so wounded. What about the more complex issues involving the presence of Israel, the United States support for Israel, the U.S. involvement now with Libya? How does all that factor into this?
Well, in terms of, I would say in the immediate future, I don't think that this wave of change in the region is going to impact these protracted conflicts or deeply rooted conflicts. In the medium and long term, definitely. I think, as you see, for example, let's say Egypt, you know, get out of this phase, develop a new government, begin to consider new options in terms of policy. I guarantee you down the road that there will be a reexamination of Egyptian policy vis-a-vis the Palestine question and reexamination of the Egyptian role in the Palestinian question. But I think that's long term. We're not going to see that materializing in the next, let's say, year or two. It's something that one would expect further down the road. What is amazing is the fact that in the area of these protracted conflicts, particularly in this case, the Palestinian issue, we haven't seen this wave of change spreading as fast as it has in certain other societies. The seeds are there. You could see some signs of young people beginning to challenge the existing order, challenge basically the conventional wisdom that has governed internal Palestinian politics, whether on the right or the left, or whether with Fatah or with Hamas. But it hasn't gone to the street yet.
So, Tom Carruthers, back to you at the Carnegie Endowment. When you talk about the diversity between all of these different countries and how different they are, what does long-term and short-term mean?
Well, I mean, there are different comparisons you can make if you're trying to get perspective. You know, in Africa 20 years ago, there was a really remarkable wave of democratization through a region that nobody had been predicting that it might take place there, and nobody thought had very good prospects for democracy. And the effects of that were very differential when we look at it 20 years later. You have a number of countries, about a third of them, that are doing pretty well, pluralistic systems, democratic norms to some extent. A third have just lapsed back into full-fledged authoritarianism, and a third are caught up in civil conflict or uncertain kinds of political situations. So I don't think it would be too surprising to imagine the Arab world, with its own range of different kinds of regimes and authoritarian traditions and practices might end up in a similar place if 20 years from now we said, well, we've got a third or so of the countries that have kind of moved ahead, a third that have slipped backward, and a third that are in between. That wouldn't surprise me at all.
Mark Levine at UC Irvine, author of Heavy Metal Islam, in Tahrir Square in Egypt some time ago. You were in Bahrain, as I understand it, when the Saudi troops arrived. What was the reaction, and did people there expect the U.S. to do something about it?
Well, they certainly expected... I mean, expect is probably not the right word. They wished the United States would have much more harshly and quickly condemned the actions of the royal family. I don't think anyone expected that the United States to do it, but they certainly would have liked it. I was with one of the main human rights monitors in the country, and he knew almost immediately that he was going to be arrested and beaten sooner or later. And in fact, a couple of days ago, he was arrested and beaten and threatened. His family was threatened. And, you know, in Bahrain, the reaction was just disgust. I mean, there was disgust that the royal family has once again gone down this path. People could not believe that they were seeing troops from Saudi Arabia on their streets. But they're also, especially among Sunnis who might have otherwise supported the protest, there was a feeling of anger that the protesters had not negotiated a little earlier, had perhaps overestimated their strength in the exuberance of Egypt, in a way perhaps similar to the Libyan protesters, and exasperation at what could be done. As one friend's mother said to me, we've lost everything. Everything we were slowly moving towards, greater liberalization and such, is now gone. So I think a lot of this is going to depend on how the Shia-led protests can actually mobilize the more middle and upper-class Sunnis to back their cause. And the harsher the government cracks down, the more likely it is that will happen.
Again, Professor Mark Levine is at UC Irvine. His most recent book, Heavy Metal Islam. He also has a compilation album called Flowers in the Desert with heavy metal, hard rock, and hip-hop bands from around the Muslim world. Thanks very much to you, Tom Carruthers at the Carnegie for Endowment for International Peace. What we just heard reminds me of your point that these countries are so very different. Khalil Jassan, formerly the president of the National Association of Arab Americans, and our other guests as well. Good to have all of you on our program today, and thanks very much for joining us. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Francis Anderton, Katie Cooper, and Sonia Geis. Our managing producer, Cameron Ranziner, technical director, Mike Newport. Email us, share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/whichwayla. Join the conversation on Which Way LA's Facebook page. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.